This is March 16th, 2014, I'm going to start off talking about the third noble truth. And then we'll find out what this talk is called after it limps to a finish. I just got through in the past month or two reading a couple books. One is Houston Smith and Philip Novak's book, Buddhism. It's a really good elementary coverage of different schools of Buddhism and the Buddha's basic teaching. And also Karen Armstrong, who wrote a book called Buddha, which I also recommend highly. And then last Sunday, Anthony Cerulli, he's a professor at Hobart William Smith, came here and gave a lecture. I think it was entitled The Four Noble Truths in Context. And I was really struck, sort of primed by what I had read and then struck by the way he presented it. I'd always thought that the third noble truth was kind of like there's nothing to it, you know. Basically, first noble truth is life is suffering, or dukkha. And, of course, we can talk a lot about what that exactly means. The second is that the cause of suffering is desire, or Roshi sometimes says egotistic desire. The word is tana, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, which I'm surely not, which means craving or desire. Literally thirst. And then the third noble truth is, the way I hear it usually summarized, is there's a way out. And I hadn't really realized before, this maybe seems like a small point, but what the Buddha said is the way out of suffering is to extinguish desire, or the way to eliminate dukkha is to extinguish tana, or thirst. The word nirvana means sort of blowing out or extinguishing, and it's also has the sense of cooling. In fact, somewhere I read that in Pali, if you set something out to cool off, you use that term, nirvana. So what we're really, what the Buddha is prescribing, and the third noble truth really is a prescription, is to cool our thirst. Maybe we could say cool our jets. This word tana, I think thirst is a really good word. It really sort of gets at the reflexive nature of it, the pervasive nature of tana. When we turn inward and start to examine ourselves and see what's going on, we all find it. I don't think there's anybody who has looked and not agreed that our lives are really, really shaped by our desires. Another way to frame it, which I'm going to use more, I think, today, is grasping and avoidance. It's basically, our problem is we're rarely satisfied with things as they are, and we're reaching out for something better, or we're pushing something that seems threatening away. If you look closely, you see how ingrained this is. And the Buddha would characterize this attitude of grasping and avoiding as simply as unskillful action. And in Buddhism, there's always that admonition to observe your strategies, let's put it that way, observe what you do and see what results you get. Grasping and avoiding cuts us off from this moment, from our life. So life only exists in this moment. And this it starts the minute we wake up. You know, so many people, and of course, whenever I say so many people, I mean me. You wake up and immediately, you know, first thing that comes into the mind is what you don't want to do, which is get out of bed. And if there's something, you know, mildly stressful coming up during your day that can occupy your mind, it's just, we just go from one thing to another, sort of with our monkey mind grasping at this and running away from that, from morning to night. It's all for the sake of making things better. It's just our bad strategy. I mean, we're trying, when we grasp at something, we grasp at it because it's going to make us feel better. And when we push something away, it's because we don't want to feel worse. So, this basic attitude is reinforced throughout our lives. It's always sobering to watch a young child grow up and get this strategy down and play it out again and again with bad results. Thinking here of my grandchildren, of course, and my children, and my parents' children. And so it's natural that when we do Zazen, when we come into Zen, you know, we bring this with us. Of course we do. What else would we do? So Zazen is a really, really, the instructions are really simple. They may be a little hard to understand, but they're really, really simple. And they're, of course, extremely difficult to do. But they're very simple. Bodhidharma is said to have said, He was known as the wall-gazing Brahman. Brahman, of course, is just the highest class, highest caste in India. That's why he's always shown with that earring, show his high status. He said he advocated something that the characters in Chinese are perceive and wall. And so that's translated sometimes as wall-gazing. But it can also be understood to perceive like a wall. And sometimes it's translated as make your mind like a wall and enter the way. Which is really evocative. You know, a wall doesn't have any agenda or any preferences. It's like a wall observing a wall. There's a Chinese master, Yao Shan, said, think, not thinking. And then more recently, in this past century, you had this Japanese Zen teacher, Uchiyama. I've read from him. He has a book called Opening the Hand of Thought, by which he means, we find ourselves clinging to our thoughts, grasping them, or pushing them away. It really doesn't make any difference which. And when we see that, it's just like opening your hand. You just let it go. It's the simple instructions for Zazen. And it's not just in Buddhism that we get this instruction. In Christianity, the instruction is be still and know that I am God. It's really getting at exactly the same thing. Really to surrender, grasping, and avoidance. To extinguish desire. It's grasping desire. The third patriarch, said, "To seek great mind with thinking mind is certainly a grave mistake." We, of course, recite that almost every day. When we sit in Zazen, we're giving up, we're surrendering that normal attitude that we've been living our lives with and that we continue to play out in our lives again and again. Doesn't matter whether we're doing shikantaza, or you got a koan, doing breath practice. For everyone, we need to do is to what's called cut off the thought road. You can, especially for old hands, it can just be, you can slip into it without even realizing it. Every time we sit down, we need to cut off the thought road. It doesn't do a whole lot of good to sit cross-legged facing the wall and run through some laundry list in our head. It's not a problem that thoughts arise. It's when we cling to them or push them away that we get lost. Tsingshan also said, "The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose." You could say, for those who do not grasp and avoid. So just take a look at a little sampling of some of the sticky thoughts that we tend to indulge in our Zazen. The first is that I want to look at is thoughts of time. It's if you've had to deal with some pain or difficulty in sitting, you may start to keep an eye, a mental eye, on where you're at in the round. You know, how much have I sat so far? How much is left? I don't know if anyone else has done this, but I certainly have. People think, okay, now they're getting up and using the stick. Halfway home, halfway home. That's why we vary when we use the stick, trying to trip you up. Eiken Roshi says something about this whole business of keeping an eye on the time. He says, the time, this is the measurement we impose on our existence. And if in your formal practice you remain aware of the passage of the periods of Zazen, you are not giving yourself a chance to let your body and mind drop away. It doesn't matter if you forget the clock. Or to put it another way, it matters very much indeed. The habit of sort of in the back of your mind keeping an eye on time is really insidious. You know, I really speaking from personal experience, need to be vigilant, and that's a thought. If you've indulged that thought, if you're the timekeeper, you need to drop it repeatedly. It's because it's gonna, if you're doing it, if that's your habit in Zazen, if you do it and if you've been doing it, well, then you're going to continue to have those thoughts come up. They have a momentum. They're not gonna stop on their own. That is, they're not gonna stop if you keep picking them up. So it's good to step back and say, okay, here's a problem I can see, and I'm going to, when these thoughts come, I'm just going to let them go. And be willing to do that as many times as it takes. Just be willing to do that. Forget about what it takes. Roshi always says, when you sit, you can set a timer and then stick that where you can't see it. It's always that temptation think, okay, I think I've sat for half an hour here. The timer has probably I forgot to set it. There's some problem. Reach behind you and pull it out. Oh, 15 minutes to go. Oh, my God. It's slightly painful not to give in to the habit force. We don't like to do that, but you really need to step up and do it. You know, it's painful thoughts that you need to let go of. You need to do it, even though it hurts to let go of them. The whole issue of keeping track of time also comes up in Sesshin. Tendency to think, okay, 2 days down, oh my God, 5 days to go, whatever. I was an inveterate keeper of time for many, many years in Sesshin. Not necessarily having a hard time, but just keeping part of my mind on where we at, oh yeah, good, halfway, okay, you know, I'm going to have to start working harder soon. But there was a point, one Sesshin, where all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, it's day five. I hadn't even been thinking about it. And that's really where we want to be. We want to just forget about time and be surprised. And that's a good sign. You can't travel across the ocean if you don't let go of the shore. I was monitoring a Sesshin once with Robert Sensei, Roshi Sanction, who teaches in Germany. And he gave a little talk in the Zendo, and it was a metaphor I'd never heard before. It's a pretty simple one, which is basically when you're hanging on to something like what time is it, or any thought that you just keep going back to, you may be working very hard, but it's like you're in a rowboat and you're rowing and you're rowing and you're rowing, but unknown to you, unbeknownst to you, your rowboat is tied to the dock. You're not going to go anywhere because you're continually going back to that habitual thought. Sometimes I think of it as trying to dive down when you're attached to a bobber. So there needs to be some vigilance, some grit, some willingness to just let that go, familiar and habitual though it is. And when we catch ourselves there, just to drop it. Doesn't mean to get discouraged. Think, oh my God, here I am again, another Sesshin, and I'm just thinking about what day it is and strategizing about how I'm going to get through to the end. I know that's a waste of time, but I can't stop. Well, yeah, you can stop right now and not worry about whether it's going to come back. Because if it comes back, you can stop. And then stop again. It's a Christian saint that Roshi Kaplow used to quote, said, "We go, we know not where, by a road we know not of." That's our condition when we let go of these habitual thoughts. We no longer grasp them. Another sticky thought in sitting, of course, is thoughts about pain, especially anticipating pain. Again, I've got a lot of experiential advice for people, because this was the biggest feature of my early Sesshins, was sitting in a round of Zazen and just scanning the horizon for the first twinge of knee pain that usually came about the time they got up to use the stick. And I would feel that twinge, and actually, before I would even feel the twinge, I would have the thought, I wonder if I'm going to feel pain, and boom, there it would be. And my magic thinking mind could actually conjure up pain in the legs. Obviously, anticipating pain, worrying about pain, makes it worse. This is the suffering on top of suffering. And obviously that keeps us on the surface. Keeps the boat tied to the dock. Of course, I want to say here, we need to pay some attention to pain. If there's a stabbing pain in your knee or some indication that you're doing physical damage, then you need to do something about it. But that's maybe 1 or 2% of the pain that we deal with. It's sometimes a good thing to be stuck in pain that we can't easily get out of, because we have a chance to really let this play out, to really find out that when we drop our demand that the pain go away or stop worrying about it, when we just say, okay, hurts like hell, oh, just go back to the practice, that all of a sudden we may find that it's not such a problem. It changes. And we also find things out about pain. You know, there's when we think about it, it's like this unremitting agony. But actually, if you go through it, it waxes and wanes. It flares up and it dies out. It's never continuous. Of course, it's not only physical pain. There's mental pain, and we tend to keep our eye out for any glimmer of that as well. It could be the pain of negative thoughts, and find ourselves trying to get rid of them, find some way out. Anxiety is a good example. Actually, these painful mind states, negative mind states, feelings of anxiety, fear, they're like physical pain in that they're a useful reminder. They tell us we've gone off track. If thoughts are painful, that's an indication that we bought into them, that we're believing them. Feeling of I'm no good, don't compare to others. It's painful to think that way. We don't need to argue our way out of it. Don't need to say no. I have the Buddha nature. I'm good enough, and gosh darn it, people like me. It's just we see it. Okay, let it go. Set it on your lap. If you try to get rid of it, if you try to throw it away, you're stuck to it. So I had cataract surgery done recently, and it's pretty awesome. Of course, I have to wear glasses to give this talk because I can't see anything close, but if I take them off, I have the eyes of an eagle. But I discovered I also have floaters, and so, you know, floaters are those little sort of blurry things that swirl around in the vitrea of your eye, and I really find myself, I've just got to suck it up. You know, if I flick my eyes from side to side, there's a little curtain that's going to run by there. And if every time that happens, I'm going, oh, shit. You know, I thought I was going to be Superman, and I'm stuck with this. So, you know, doctor tells me, well, they may die down with time, and he also tells me, yeah, there's nothing we can do about them. So that's dukkha. That's our life. It's a problem if I let it bother me. You know, it's a problem if I go, this really, really sucks. I wish it weren't this way. Well, guess what? It is this way. That's how it is. That's not a problem. It's just not a problem. Okay, another thought, another set of thoughts in sitting. And that's the whole business of evaluating and grasping at mind states. I don't know if this might be the most difficult, at least for me, because what we're doing in sitting is, aren't we trying to get into a good mind state? Aren't we trying to get into samadhi? So if you're trying to do something, what's wrong with trying to do it? Well, what's wrong is that doesn't work. You can't, you are not in the business of trying to create a mind state. So that's why practice is so simple. Your job is not to get into a concentrated state of mind. Your job is to turn the mind to the breath or turn the mind to the koan, whatever the practice is. The samadhi, the concentration, happens outside of your control. If it happens within your control, it's fake. So it's a classic example of the unskillful use of the mind. Thoughts like, okay, my sitting's really going good now. Can't wait till the round is over and I can get up to Doksan and tell Roshi how well I'm sitting. Mm-hmm. Or, oh shit, now I've lost it. Mm-hmm. Eventually, if we're lucky, if we keep at it, we'll lose some interest in keeping score. It's really the only way out. Just not to care so much. Some rounds are good, some rounds are not so good. I can't even tell which is which because I'm not in a position to judge. Can just enjoy the breath. Just enjoy letting go. It is enjoyable. It's wonderful not to do all these things that don't work. It's like a hall of mirrors. You try to manipulate the mind. Even trying to get Mu in focus. Why do you want to do that? Just Mu. If you just give your mind to the practice, focus happens. But if you're grasping, if you're trying to get rid of your confusion, if you're trying to hang on to your concentration, you're working against yourself. You're tying the boat to the dock. Now, there's a movement in psychotherapy. I don't know, movement, a school, or whatever. I've talked about it before. It's called ACT, which stands for Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. It really, really has a good way of getting at our habitual and unskillful approach to our suffering. A lot of the books on ACT, it's pronounced ACT, not ACT, lead off with the phrase, life is suffering, or some variant on that. And I've read a lot of stuff where people get quite indignant and say, come on, you're ripping off Buddhism. You know, this is clearly just Buddhism repackaged as psychotherapy. And the response is, get over it, you know? I mean, I wish Buddhism could be repackaged more in more places. A lot of times the repackaging that's done, and I'm thinking also of Jon Kabat-Zinn with his mindfulness-based stress reduction, it's repackaged so more people will look at it. Because if you come to people and say, hey, Buddhism, you know, most people are going to go the other way. It's not American, is it? Even in China, Buddhism is considered foreign, or at least was, probably still is. And that was the reason behind some of the persecutions of Buddhism that we hear about, the evil Emperor Wu. So if these basic teachings, don't belong to Buddhism, they don't belong to anyone. The Buddha himself said, don't believe something because the Buddha says so. Try it out for yourself. If it works, keep it. And if it doesn't work, throw it away. It's totally pragmatic. And that's kind of what I like about this form of psychotherapy, is that it is so pragmatic and that it gets at the difficulty in a slightly different way that sometimes can sort of let us see it in a slightly different way. I'm going to read a little bit from something called Act Made Simple by a guy named Russ Harris. He was a Brit, a doctor, who migrated to Australia and at some point switched to psychology. He wrote a book called The Happiness Trap, which I haven't read, but I probably will. But what I'm going to read here is from Act Made Simple. And he's talking about something he calls experiential avoidance. They abbreviated EA. So experiential avoidance is really what some of what we're talking about with this whole question of grasping and avoidance. So he says experiential avoidance means trying to avoid, get rid of, suppress, or escape from unwanted private experiences. That's in quotation marks, private experiences. ACT uses the term to mean any experience you have that no one else knows about unless you tell them. For example, thoughts, feelings, memories, images, urges, and sensations. Experiential avoidance is something that comes naturally to all humans. So this is a little section there that says how experiential avoidance increases suffering. Let's consider how it increases suffering. Addictions provide an obvious example. Many addictions begin as an attempt to avoid or get rid of unwanted thoughts and feelings such as boredom, loneliness, anxiety, guilt, anger, sadness, and so on. In the short run, gambling, drugs, alcohol, and cigarettes will often help people, not necessarily all at once, but will often help people to avoid or get rid of these feelings temporarily. But in the long run, a huge amount of pain and suffering results. And that's the thing about experiential avoidance. I'm sure you'll say more about it as I read further, but it works in the short term. We have this bad feeling, there's something we don't want to feel, and then we have our strategy to make that go away. It might be something as simple as having a donut, whatever. There's something we do that just takes us and gives us something else to cling to. It says the more time and energy we spend trying to avoid or get rid of unwanted private experiences, the more we're likely to suffer psychologically in the long run. Anxiety disorders provide a good example. Okay. It's not the presence of anxiety that comprises the essence of an anxiety disorder. It's not the presence of anxiety. After all, anxiety is a normal human emotion that we all experience. At the core of any anxiety disorder lies excessive experiential avoidance, a life dominated by trying very hard to avoid or get rid of anxiety. The problem is getting rid of it, trying to get rid of it. For example, suppose I feel anxious in social situations and in order to avoid those feelings of anxiety, I stopped socializing. Now I have social phobia. The short-term benefit is obvious. I get to avoid some anxious thoughts and feelings. But the long-term cost is huge. I become isolated, and my life gets smaller. Happens in so many areas. We take what's really the easy way out, and then we pay the price. And because we focus short-term, we're unconsciously just aware of the, okay, when I decide to stay in bed, that bad feeling is held at bay. We don't look so clearly at, when I decide to stay in bed, I don't get done the things that I wanted and planned to do. It says, alternatively, I may try to reduce my anxiety by playing the role of good listener. I become very empathic and caring toward others, and in social interactions, I discover lots of information about their thoughts, feelings, and desires, but I reveal little or nothing of myself. This helps in the short run to reduce my fear of being judged or rejected, but in the long run, it means my relationships lack intimacy, openness, and authenticity. Suppose I take Valium or some other benzodiazepine to reduce my anxiety. Again, the short-term benefit is obvious, less anxiety. But long-term costs of relying on benzodiazepines, antidepressants, marijuana, or alcohol to reduce my anxiety could include A, psychological dependence on my medication, B, possible physical addiction, C, other physical and emotional side effects, D, financial costs, and C, failure to learn more effective responses to anxiety, which therefore maintains or exacerbates the issue. Still another way I might respond to my social anxiety would be to grit my teeth and socialize despite my anxiety. This is really interesting. That is, to tolerate the feelings even though I'm distressed by them. From an ACT perspective, this too would be experiential avoidance. Why? Because although I'm not avoiding the situation, I'm still struggling with my feelings and desperately hoping they'll go away. That's the issue. The desire that they go away. The desire that things be different. That's the problem. That's what keeps us stuck. It's counterintuitive. But when you look at it this way, it's pretty clear. He says, this is tolerance, not acceptance. If I truly accept my feelings, then even though they may be very unpleasant and uncomfortable, I'm not distressed by them. There it is, that floater in front of the eye. But it's not a problem. The problem is when we don't want it to be the way it is. To get the distinction between tolerance and acceptance, consider this. Would you want the people you love to tolerate you while you're present, hoping you'll go away and frequently checking to see if you're gone yet? Or would you prefer them to completely and totally accept you as you are with all your flaws and foibles and to be willing to have you around for as long as you choose to stay? Such a radically different attitude to take towards anything that's aversive. Such a radically different way to value what's painful. I know in some, I think I read somewhere that in ACT they're tending to not use the word acceptance so much because for a lot of people, it sounds like defeat or surrender. Oh, you're just going to give up. Accept it. But that's tolerance. Acceptance is different. Acceptance is to be pleased to play the cards that you've been dealt. It's like some old person, I don't know any, but some old person who's got a laundry list of all the things that are wrong, and yet it's great to be alive. My eyes are dim. My arthritis is kicking up. My feet are deformed. Life is good. My dad used to say, "Who wants to be 90 years old?" Then he would answer himself, "An 89-year-old. Going back to Russ Harris, the cost of tolerating my anxiety, that is, gritting my teeth and putting up with it, is that it takes a huge amount of effort and energy, and it makes it hard to remain fully engaged in any social interaction. As a consequence, I miss out on much of the pleasure and fulfillment that commonly accompanies social interaction, and this in turn increases my anxiety about future social events because I won't enjoy it, or I'll feel awful, or it's too much effort. Sadly, the more importance we place on avoiding anxiety, the more we develop anxiety about our anxiety. It's a vicious cycle found at the center of any anxiety disorder. After all, what is the core of a panic attack if not anxiety about anxiety? A large body of research shows that higher experiential avoidance is associated with anxiety disorders, excessive worrying, depression, poorer work performance, higher levels of substance abuse, lower quality of life, high-risk sexual behavior, borderline personality disorder, greater severity of PTSD, it's a post-traumatic stress disorder, long-term disability, and higher degrees of overall psychopathology. Indeed, it's arguably the single biggest factor in psychopathology. So now you can see one reason why ACT doesn't focus on symptom reduction. To do so is likely to reinforce experiential avoidance, the very process that fuels most clinical issues. Another reason is that attempts to reduce symptoms can paradoxically increase them. For example, research shows that suppression of unwanted thoughts can lead to a rebound effect, an increase in both intensity and frequency of the unwanted thoughts. Other studies show that trying to suppress a mood can actually intensify it in a self-amplifying loop. There's another metaphor they use, which is, you know how many people have ever played with those Chinese finger traps? It's a little sort of tube. You stick your fingers in, and then as you pull it out, it tightens around your fingers. So the harder you pull, the less able you are to get out of it. The only way to get out of that finger trap is to push your fingers together, and then they loosen and you can remove them. Really all about skillful means. They did rip off the Buddha. Some of our thoughts, like anxiety or thoughts about time or pain, are relatively easy to see, but there's also the thoughts that we barely even know that we have. They're more subtle. I was once back in my degenerate days. I was smoking pot with some friends, and just feeling really, really uncomfortable. In fact, I don't know why I smoked pot. It always made me slightly uncomfortable. Anyway, I did it because I was stupid, of course. But I suddenly realized the reason why I felt uncomfortable was because of a sort of negative attitude about other people. I suddenly realized that the problem was that I didn't love other people. It was like this sort of little glimmer or window that, oh, if you just turn that switch, if you just... Because really, when you think about it, people are lovable. They really are. Why do we close ourselves off? Why do we protect ourselves by that sort of, oh, Jesus, he's so boring, or you know, that person's a phony, or who do they think they are? That whole negative cast of mind, we can carry that around with us and not even really know that it's there because the thoughts are so fleeting and quick. But we just find ourselves, you see it when somebody walks in the room and asks a question and your immediate reaction is annoyance. What's going on there? There's something subtle that you're not seeing. The Buddha taught something called the Four Immeasurables. Some of them we're a bit familiar with. The first is metta, or loving kindness. The second is karuna, or compassion. Third is mudita, sympathetic joy. That is taking pleasure in the good fortune of others. And the fourth is upekkha. I hope I'm pronouncing that close. Or equanimity. It's extremely encouraging to feel a glimmer of sympathetic joy, let's say, or just to feel some calm. It's really an indication that we've let go of something. It's how practice works. To begin to be able to sit quietly in a room, say in our house or apartment, without a pull to be somewhere or do something. Quiet noises in the background, maybe there are birds chirping outside. It's to have that space, that sense of spaciousness. It's where practice brings us. I think the highest, some people argue, the highest of the four immeasurables is equanimity. The American Buddhist monk Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote, "The real meaning of upekkha is equanimity, not indifference in the sense of unconcern for others. As a spiritual value, it means stability in the face of the fluctuations of worldly fortune. It is evenness of mind, unshakable freedom of mind, a state of inner equipoise that cannot be upset by gain and loss, honor and dishonor, praise and blame, pleasure and pain." I think those are the eight worldly winds, I suspect. Upekkha is freedom from all points of self-reference. Freedom from all points of self-reference. It is indifference only to the demands of the ego self with its craving for pleasure and position, not to the well-being of one's fellow human beings. True equanimity is the pinnacle of the four social attitudes that the Buddhist texts call the divine abodes. It's the four immeasurables. The last does not override and negate the previous three, but perfects and consummates them. A Zen master was once asked, what is the teaching of all the Buddhas? And he said, do good, avoid evil. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas. And this was the bird's nest monk who's sitting up in a tree at the time. And the Chinese government official who had come to ask him said, well, that's pretty simple. Even a child knows that. And the teacher replied, even a child knows it, but a man of 80 is hard put to put it into practice. It's we put aside our agenda, put aside our grasping. Then we can actually do what needs to be done. We can do good. We can avoid evil. This is a big feature in ACT, which is to, despite all these negative internal feelings, to do what needs to be done. It's not that we have to get rid of any negative feelings. We simply have to stop being ordered about by them. We have to stop trying to stop them. Let them be. Set the snow globe down and let it settle. It's do good, avoid evil. It's not feel good, don't feel bad. This is what we can do when we stop the struggle with tanha, with this desire, with this thirst, when it begins to cool. That we can sit quietly in an empty room. Well, I hear a bell ringing, and I suspect I've used up more than all of my time. Truman, where are we at?
Yeah, it is 10:30. I didn't time it, though. I think it's at least 40 minutes.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
We do have time for questions.
Yeah, if anybody has any question or comment, anything at all. Yes, Devin.
Jen, I'm curious, what other thoughts have you become aware of that were not, so obvious to you during your many years of sesshin?
Oh, you mean thoughts in sesshin?
What subtle thoughts have you become aware of?
Yeah. Well, it's the one you don't look for is just unconsciously waiting for things to click. It's always that hypervigilance. You're casting the mind out ahead for the state that's going to come, and it's so easy to be doing that and not realize that we're doing it. You notice when you stop doing it because all of a sudden you're in this really wonderful place. And then, of course, that passes because everything passes. And now you're trying to get back to that wonderful place by casting your mind out ahead. So we're continually doing exactly what doesn't work. And we continually have to relearn. They say in AA, if you keep walking into a wall, then you need to turn left or right. So hopefully, if we keep at this, we become more skillful. I love the fact that the Buddha put everything in terms of skillfulness, skillful means. It's not moral, it's not good or bad, it's just this works, this doesn't work.
Sean?
Yeah.
Could you say a few words about this phenomenon? I know I've certainly experienced it, and others tell me they have too, of almost masochistically wanting to cling to painful thoughts and not let them go.
Yeah. I'm sure there are different things that operate. Sometimes If it's, for instance, here's one example, is resentments, you know, which are one painful thought. There's the feeling that if I let them go, I'm accepting them. Mm-hmm. You know, that if I let them go, I need to struggle against them because they're unacceptable. You know, that this is so painful, I can't let this in. And that traps us there, you know. And it's not easy to do, you know. Say it's anxiety. To say I'm okay with being anxious, it's very hard to do that. And what most people, you know, who try to do that do, say, I'm going to try to be okay with anxiety so that it will go away. And that's, no, that's not it. You know, there's a saying, another saying in AA, half measures availed us nothing. We really need to just take the plunge and say, I'm going to be with things the way they are and let it play out however it plays out. And when I forget, I'm going to go back to it. And of course, Zazen is so wonderful because it gives us a really simple way to do that. You know, if you have a breath practice, how wonderful is that? Just, you don't have to think it through. You don't have to hold anything in your mind. You just go to the breath. And then the process works outside of our purview, outside of our control. Need to have faith in it. Need to keep doing it. You know, we dig a well, you dig and you dig and you dig, and where's the water? Well, it takes a while. You find the water when you keep digging. Yeah. Yeah, Calvin.
So about this experiential avoidance.
Yeah.
Counter example. So you're sitting and you start wondering, when is this going to end? And you don't like that. So you go, woo, 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 woo. Some people even shout. that sounds like exactly how you were describing the experiential avoidance.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's exactly the recommendation.
Well, it depends on whether you're trying to push the thought away or you're letting it go. So, yeah. If you turn the mind, and the same recommendation Roshi has for physical pain, you know, just basically get into mu. But if you get into mu in order to get rid of the physical pain, if it's experiential avoidance, you're bringing the pain with you into your concentration on mu because you've got that result in your mind. So I think it's semantics. I think they're
so basically you don't know how to do it until you know how to do it.
Yeah, and even then you don't know how to do it. Like Dogen said, if you find you've gone all the way, keep going. Okay, well, I hear little children running around out there. I'm sure they're hungry, so we'll stop now and recite the four vows.